Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There is a new Massachusetts U.S. attorney in town. Rachel Rollins, the first Black woman to serve as district attorney in Suffolk County, became the first Black woman in the U.S. attorney's post, too. She was sworn in earlier this month. Now, no stranger to controversy as a reformer, Rollins' swearing in came only after a bruising confirmation in the U.S. Senate. She was so controversial that the Senate took its first roll call vote on a U.S. attorney nominee since the 1970s. Rollins also faced threats against her life, so many that local faith leaders called on the Justice Department to give her a full-time security detail. The U.S. Marshal's Office declined to comment to WBUR about the status of that request. Rollins dialed into Studio 4 earlier today to reflect on her first days on the job, and I started by asking her, given the tremendous headwinds she's faced, is she having any fun?
I actually am. It is such a privilege to come back to an office that I learned from. I had worked as an assistant United States attorney for almost 5 years when I was a younger lawyer. So to be able to come back to the place that I believe taught me about lawyering is really just very humbling and an honor. And we are having fun. I mean, we deal with incredibly serious cases, but we have a really great group of individuals, some of whom I've worked with for many, many years and knew when I was here, others of whom that are new. But yes, we try to make sure that we are kind to each other and enjoying our company because the work we do is really hard and important.
So you do call the shots now. I wonder if there was a moment when you were in the office before as a more junior person where you thought, boy, one day if I'm ever in that seat, this is what I'm going to do. And now you have a chance to do it. Was there ever a moment like that that you can remember?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there is certainly autonomy as U.S. attorney, and we will use it, I will, as my predecessors have. But I believe there were some cases when I was a younger AUSA where I thought, wow, what is the policy behind this? I'm not going to tell you what those exactly were at the time, but I will tell you it's really interesting now sitting in this seat to see all the thought that goes into the policy decisions we make that impact people all across the country.
That makes me think about a couple of cases that you've been handed. Two in particular, one that recently you and the federal government dismissed, and that was MIT professor Gong Chen. Your predecessor, Andrew Lelling, filed charges against him. It was part of a larger effort to go after theft, intellectual theft from China. The accusations against him were that he failed to reveal information about contacts or connections with China that later, it sounds like, we discovered he wasn't actually required to reveal in some federal applications. There's that one, and then there's an immigration case that involves a judge from Newton who didn't like an ICE agent standing outside her courtroom door waiting for somebody who was inside and chose to help that defendant out the back door. When you're handed cases like, and that one's still being prosecuted, when you're handed cases like that, how do you think about whether they match the values you want to bring to the office? You know, I got to assume there's a bit of a knot, like a moral knot for you in things like that.
Sometimes there is, but I want to be clear. There's nothing different sitting in this seat as there was when I was the DA of Suffolk County. I am always going to encourage whatever prosecutors I have the privilege of working with to do a rigorous review at every point of whether or not we can prove our case. And we should never require somebody, and I'm not implying that we were going to do this in these two cases, but the government should never require somebody to have to go to trial and get a not guilty if we know we couldn't prove the case in the first place. So with respect to the Chen case, which I can speak about because it's a matter that is no longer pending, there was a determination that there were issues with respect to materiality. And I am always going to encourage my prosecutors to come to us when we believe the landscape has changed, that we can't prove our fundamental elements. This is an opportunity for us to explain to prosecutors how powerful we are. The decisions we make impact people's lives. And so when things are ever shifting and changing, we have to be nimble enough to immediately acknowledge if there is new evidence or new facts, and I'm talking generally now, or different shifting theories. We should always be open to those things, because as the government, we have so much power to deeply impact people's lives.
We're talking with U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins in the early days of her tenure. You've said that two of the areas that you really want to pursue as U.S. attorney have to do with drugs and with sex trafficking. I want to talk about both of them. I was struck by your push to address sex trafficking in the Commonwealth, and you've said you believe it's happening significantly here. And I was thinking about this in preparing for our conversation last night, and I was thinking, there's somebody's story. There's somebody's story you learned or they told you that must have pushed you, drew you in this direction. Is there a story out there that really compelled you?
There are so many stories that have compelled me. I think amazing organizations like My Life, My Choice has done such an important job of educating us about how predatory certain individuals can be, how they look at vulnerable populations of young women often, but there are young men and men that are trafficked as well. So there are so many stories to tell. And, you know, I've always said it's the survivor's story to tell, not mine, but I have been most moved by that work when I was district attorney. And it is my sincere hope and intent as U.S. attorney that we are going to be far more active in the sex trafficking realm, as well as the drug trafficking and gun trafficking worlds, where there oftentimes is overlap.
So I want to stay with that for a minute. You are talking about drug trafficking. I know that the crisis at the intersection of Melnia Cass Boulevard and Massachusetts Avenue has loomed large for you. You've talked to WBUR from the streets there. And again, as you talked about wanting to take on drug trafficking, which has been a big area of complaint for people experiencing that neighborhood, I wonder, is there a person who's sort of sitting on your shoulder, somebody that you met at Mass and Cass, somebody whose experience you learned, that stays with you, that is sitting on your shoulder as you think about how you want to prosecute these changes and make change there?
Sitting on my shoulder, I have people coursing through my veins. I'm the guardian of two of my nieces because of the opioid crisis. So I have siblings that are struggling with this right now. I've been to more graduations from programs than I could imagine as a sibling, not as a district attorney, not as a U.S. attorney. I look at the people, the humans on Mass Ave and Melnia Cass as potential family members of mine, because I've walked on those streets looking for people that I love to make sure they're alive or to see if they're doing well. So I take this very, very personally, and was proud to sit at the table with Governor Baker and Attorney General Healey and different secretaries at the state level with respect to housing and mental health and public health. So we have the right people sitting at the table making these decisions now. It can't simply be a carceral response. You bet there needs to be a carceral response with respect to those traffickers that are going down there and taking advantage of people who are trying desperately to seek help for a disease, a health condition that they have. But I don't believe that we should be targeting individuals that suffer from a substance use disorder. I think we should be getting them treatment and help overwhelmingly, and then focusing the carceral response at the DA level, at the Attorney General level, or at the U.S. Attorney level to bring the full weight of the criminal legal system down upon people trafficking in harm. And we need to be very clear, sex trafficking is happening down there quite a bit as well. So those are the things that I think about, in particular now with January being Human Trafficking Prevention Month. We are talking with all of our local, state, and federal partners about these important issues.
You have custody of your two nieces. They're fairly young. You just talked about them as being a source of motivation for you. How do you talk to them about the job you're doing now? How do you explain it to them? And what do you tell them you're trying to do in the world?
Well, the first thing I tell them is that I'm really proud to be only the second, I use the word girl because they're girls, even though I'm a woman, to have this job. And that I tell them every day that little girls and young women and women can do anything they put their mind to if they work really hard and if they are decent and fair and kind people. So we talk about that all the time. It was a little different, I think, with the district attorney job. They would see me on TV, for example, at a crime scene, and they understood, you know, if Commissioner Gross or Commissioner Long called that somebody was probably hurt. You know, I don't know whether they understand, you know, their 8 and 12, the China initiative or like national security issues. But I try to explain that this is a job where we really try to keep now the entire state healthy and safe. I also try to talk to them about like fun things like Coco Melon and going to, you know, ice skating and stuff. But they do definitely recognize the importance of the work that I'm trying to do here.
So can I get my policy geek on with you for just a minute?
For sure.
We have this situation in Massachusetts where there's some things around drug policy that either cities and towns want to do or that the state has done, which are different than what federal law is. The obvious one is that recreational marijuana use is legal in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's illegal federally. But we've also got some cities and towns like Somerville that want to implement sites that allow one to safely inject illegal drugs under supervision to ensure health and safety, despite the fact that those drugs are illegal. We have talked about Mass and Cass. We have talked about the homelessness and addiction crisis there. There is research to suggest that something like a supervised consumption site can improve health outcomes. It's illegal. How do you think about the tension between those two things, and what do you want to signal in the Commonwealth?
It's a fascinating point, and I've thought about this quite a bit. You know, the intersectionality of state and federal worlds, right? In my previous role as DA, I, along with DA Ryan, you know, I would say famously, filed an injunction against ICE to stop entering state courthouses when we were trying to prosecute cases to detain people, and we were successful. Now, in the role that I sit in as the US attorney, I would have been, you know, defending ICE's behavior or sitting in a courtroom watching my AUSA and somebody from Maine Justice arguing that what ICE was doing was lawful. It's really interesting, you know, with the ICE matter, with respect to marijuana, which of course our state has made it very clear that not only with recreational but medicinal, that the voters have spoken and said that they do not believe that these should be criminalized in up to certain amounts. And then certainly with respect to supervised consumption sites or harm reduction facilities, that would be in violation of the Controlled Substance Act on the federal side. So what we are doing, honestly, is we are looking to the Department of Justice for guidance. Places like Philadelphia have filed injunctions. We know that there are other places in the country that are moving forward, but with the wisdom of Attorney General Garland and Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, we are going to see what the policy is going to be of the United States. And then we'll make sure that in those handful of states, for example, with respect to marijuana that have legalized it, we're going to have discussions about, well, what do we, how do we reconcile sort of the voice of the voters or the residents of our Commonwealth with what our policies are? And then ultimately, you know, I took this job. We're going to do what it is the Department of Justice says that we're going to do. We're going to follow what the policy is of the Department of Justice. But most importantly, we're going to explain it to people. And whether they are happy or not is up to them. But what we aren't going to do is have the answer just constantly be, we have no comment. We aren't going to speak on that. We're going to explain to them why, if there are things that they have questions about or want to know a little bit more about, if we are permitted to speak about them, we're going to explain them in a way that people can understand.
Last question for you. What can't we see in the public that you, as a first in this U.S. Attorney's Office, are doing and you want us to know?
That we are trying desperately, my first assistant and I, to make this office, not only the 300 to 350 or so people who work here, feel comfortable, right? Because change is really hard. And there was a long road for me getting here. So we want them to know that we value them. We are going to learn as much as we can about the office as quickly as we can. But also that there are going to be ways that this office, I think, is a little more accessible to the Commonwealth. And I guess just how much work goes into collaboration building, not just with your staff and coworkers, but all of our external partners. We just put a lot of work into trying to hear as many opinions prior to making any changes so we can try to get it right.
All right. That is Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's imagine you take a DNA test, one like 23andMe, that looks at your genetics and your heritage. You send it off, just expecting that in a few weeks you might know a bit more about your great-great-grandparents, or maybe you find out you're related to a celebrity. But instead of that, you find out the man who raised you isn't your biological father. That's what two newly united half-brothers are grappling with as they come to terms with their genetic results. They share a father. They were both born at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore, just 15 months apart, in the late 1950s. But only one of these brothers grew up with that biological father. The other had no idea his dad, the man who raised him, wasn't actually related to him. And this story doesn't come from a love affair between parents. Nope, there is a further twist. We sat down with those half-brothers, Adam Weisenberg and Michael Yaffe, to hear their story. I started by asking Michael, why did you do it? Your cousin wants genetics tests for the family. What was it for, and what happens when the results come back?
Like many Ashkenazi Jews who immigrated from Russia during the pogroms, it wasn't really very clear if Yaffe was even the true family name or if that had been taken because it had a better pedigree, and there were rumors that cousins had taken other people's names in order to use their passports. And so my cousin was very interested in trying to understand what the true family lineage was. And as part of that, he sent a bunch of cousins a DNA test and asked whether we would be willing to do it. I, of course, didn't hesitate for a moment. I didn't have the slightest doubt that I was a Yaffe. So why would I hesitate to do the test? So I sent the test off and the results were unexpected.
How'd you find out?
My cousin, Phil, who was the most laid-back person in the universe, called me up on the phone about a month later. I wasn't even interested in the results, and I sent everything to Phil, and I said, go have fun, knock yourself out. And then he called me up about a month later, and he was very nervous on the phone, which was not typical. And he said, did you get any of my emails? No, I hadn't received any of his emails. And he started stammering, which I have never heard him do. And I said, Phil, what's up? What'd you find out? What am I, like, illegitimate or something? To which he replied, well, in short, yes.
How did that feel?
I couldn't believe it. Once he explained to me that I wasn't genetically related to anyone else in the family, my first thought was, the answer to this is obvious. Those idiots at Ancestry.com must have just lost my test. They must have confused me with someone else. But to make a long story short, we found a way to test that, and that was not the problem. And then I thought, well, I must have been adopted. Maybe this was an adoption, but we found my birth certificate, and there's a special mark that's supposed to happen in Maryland if you're adopted, and that mark wasn't there. And so then for the next few weeks, I felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me, and I no longer knew who I was.
Michael, I'm assuming both your parents had passed away and you couldn't just ask them.
Both my parents, my aunts and uncles, basically everyone in the family who would have been able to reveal this to me was deceased.
So we will come back in a second to, okay, so what happened, right? How did this, but I want to bring Adam in for just a second here. Adam, you must have taken one of these tests too, or ultimately the two of you would not have been able to make this connection, right?
Actually, no, it wasn't me. Our nephew, our sister's youngest son, was in the Ancestry.com database, and he can't even remember why he did the test, but he was in there from about 4 years before. So actually, I've never done it.
So how does it feel to know that you did not choose to share your genetic information, but you could have your whole life changed because a nephew did, and then some stranger, who turns out, you know, to be your brother, but some stranger also does, and now your life just turns upside down.
Well, I'm very happy about it. I know there are situations that people find themselves in that don't go well, but I'm absolutely delighted. Mike and I have, you know, a literal bromance, okay? He's terrific.
So there are so many pieces of this story that, you know, I'm sure listeners want to hear all at once. We got to unfold this. So, Michael, I'm going to come back to you for just a second here. So why wasn't your father your biological father?
So, as I later discovered, it turns out that he and my mother had been married for 4 years before they had me. And you have to remember, this was the 1950s, so it wasn't too long after World War II, and there was a lot of pressure on Jewish families to have children. And so apparently Sinai Hospital, where I was born, was a hotbed of activity that was not commonly known except among certain portions of the community, and that was using sperm donors for couples that were infertile. And the technique at the time was called mixed insemination or confused insemination. They would take the father's sperm and the donor's sperm and mix them and use that to inseminate the mom. And they would tell the parents that the donor sperm might contain useful things that would help the father's sperm to work better. And since there was no genetic testing, who would ever know anyway?
But it turned out that, in fact, the donor's sperm fertilized the egg and led to you.
Correct. And, of course, in those days, which was pre-HIV, there was no way you could freeze sperm. And so the donors had to be people who were easily accessible and could provide samples basically at will. And this ended up being primarily residents and young attending physicians at the hospital. So undoubtedly, the people who were used as sperm donors were physicians or physicians in training at Sinai Hospital.
So, Adam, that means your dad was a sperm donor.
Absolutely. That's right, which I didn't know about.
Now, is he living?
No. He passed away almost 20 years ago.
So was he a resident in the area at the time? Was he a physician at the hospital? What was it?
He was a resident at Sinai Hospital, actually in OBGYN. So his reasons for doing it might have been it was a good deed and so forth, but he probably also wanted the money because I think they got paid something that probably was significant considering how poorly paid residents were in those days.
So you two were born 15 months apart. How old was your dad when you were born, Adam?
He was about 30 years old.
Yeah. Michael, how did you solve this puzzle?
So what was interesting was my wife, Sung-Yun, has a friend from music camp when they were kids, and that's Jennifer Mendelsohn. And Jennifer Mendelsohn specializes in tracking down the genealogy of Ashkenazi Jews. And she had just solved a related problem to mine for someone else whose parent, biological parent, turned out to be a urologist at Sinai Hospital. And so as soon as Sung-Yun asked if she would help with my case, and she heard that I was born at Sinai Hospital, she already had an inkling of what was going on here. So she, in turn, together with my wife, looked at the pedigree, as did my cousin Phil, and said, do you know that the closest relative you have is this person named Jacob Chaliff? And I'd never heard of Jacob Chaliff, but fortunately, he had posted parts of a pedigree at the Ancestry.com website.
Is this Adam's nephew?
Both our nephews, yes.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm still having trouble getting my head around this. Okay, so this is the nephew. Sorry, Michael, go ahead.
So at that point, he had posted some of the links, and the relationship that came up said that I was this person's half-uncle, which meant that somehow one of his grandparents must have been one of my parents. And of the grandparents he listed, only one had the last name. So that was the first person who we Googled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to tell you a little bit about myself that made this particularly eerie. So I'm an MD, PhD, and I teach at MIT, and I do clinical work at Harvard Medical School. And ever since I can remember, since I was a young child, all I wanted to be was a doctor. And I especially wanted to be a surgeon. I used to operate on my stuffed animals. That was all I ever wanted to be. Now, no one else in the Yaffe family is a doctor. No one else is even in science. So this was always a little bit strange. In addition, My laboratory research is basically all about DNA damage, and our focus has been on women's cancers. So when I Googled this person who was in Jacob Chalif's family tree, and it came up with Morris Weisenberg, who had passed away, and I read his obituary, the first thing it said was, from his earliest youth, Dr. Morris Weisenberg wanted to be a physician.
And this is your father?
This is my father. And then it said he became an OBGYN, a surgical subspecialist, who then did a second residency in radiation oncology and spent his entire career inducing and studying DNA damage induced by radiation, particularly in women's cancers.
Okay, I've got goosebumps from that. So Adam, what do you do? Just out of curiosity, right?
I'm a lawyer.
You didn't follow the path.
No, it's hilarious. When Michael and I finally talked, I don't mean to get ahead of it, but it is sort of amazing. He wanted to know what Dad was like and everything. And I said, you know what? He would have loved you. As a matter of fact, you'd be his favorite child.
All right. So let's talk about how you met. Adam, how does this come into your life one day?
Well, I was a little slow on the uptake. Okay. So I guess Michael had been cautioned by Jennifer to be careful because I guess a lot of families don't respond well to somebody coming out of the woodwork. So Michael reached out to me on LinkedIn with a connection request, but it took us a couple of tries. This is actually a pretty good story.
Go for
Michael,
it.
Why don't you?
Okay. So when I read the obituary for Dr. Weisenberg, it listed his children, one of whom said was Adam Weisenberg of Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is, of course, where I work. And I remembered sometimes when I was walking through Cambridge, people would call me by the wrong name. And I had even had a few people say to me, do you know that you have a double walking around Cambridge, which I frankly denied because there were no Yaffes I knew of in Cambridge. So I then Googled Adam Weisenberg, and up came a page from his law firm with his photograph on it. And it was as though I were looking in the mirror.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of the two of you. You're like twins.
I had my wife come over and she said, well, there's no doubt now, is there?
So what was in the LinkedIn message to Adam?
So my first response was I was going to grab the phone and call him up and say, hi, you don't know me, I'm your brother. And I was cautioned very strongly not to do that, that many families, right, might not be interested in this. Perhaps there were 30 other sperm donor kids like me who had already reached out. And so I thought, well, the best thing to do would be to just acknowledge that I think sometimes people mistake the two of us and I think we share a great similarity. So I sent him an email and I said, hi, I've been told there's someone in Cambridge that looks a lot like me. I think it might be you.
And my response was, oh, yeah, I see the resemblance. That's cool. And then, like a day later, he followed up with a second message.
Which said?
It'd be cool to meet up and get to know one another. And I thought, this is a little strange. I didn't know if I was being, stalked or, what was going on or whatever. And I remember, I had no idea what the actual agenda was here, right? He was being so subtle. Well, maybe he wasn't being that subtle, but I was being so thick-headed, I didn't understand that there was something more to the story. So, but I said, oh, he's a professor, maybe they could be a little bit eccentric or whatever. And so I just responded and said, oh, yeah, that'd be great, like when this pandemic is over. I didn't hear anything more for a while. I think Mike was hoping I would reach out to him, but I failed him on that score.
For how long, Mike, is for a while? Mike,
it was about a week, or 10 days. And every day I was like, because I had given him my other email address and my phone number, and I was waiting for some hint and nothing came. Then I started to get depressed. I thought, this isn't working. I'm not sure what to do. And my wife said, why don't you just fess up? Maybe he thinks you're stalking him, right? Why don't you just fess up and just tell him what's going on? So I decided, okay. So I wrote an email, a longer email, and I said, my wife said I should just be more upfront about it. So here goes. I'm virtually certain that you and I are half brothers. And then I told the story that I've just told you.
So that must have gotten your attention, Adam.
Well, the problem was the timing of it. So this came in the Tuesday of the week before Thanksgiving. And the first set of messages was like at the very beginning of October. So it was several weeks later, actually, by the time Mike sent this to me. And I was really busy with work. Daughter was coming in for Thanksgiving and so forth. And so I didn't go to the LinkedIn website and even read the message until the Monday after Thanksgiving. And then I saw the message, which said exactly what Mike said. And I said, oh, I felt so terrible that I'd kept him hanging now for, almost 2 weeks, 13 days. So I immediately fired back a message on LinkedIn that said, I'm sorry, I just saw this message, call me. And then I waited by my phone and it didn't ring. And then I realized, okay, maybe that's a little abrupt. He doesn't know why I'm saying call me. So then I wrote a longer message saying, I'm really looking forward to talking to you and talking a little bit about the family and so forth. My phone still didn't ring.
So when I got the first message that said, call me, I thought, okay, this is when, you know, the Weisenbergs say, yeah, we've had a bunch of you guys. We're really not interested in meeting with you. It's been 2 weeks. You know, we're really not interested. Thanks a lot. Have a nice life. And then the second message came and I was hesitant to read it because I thought maybe I didn't call. So now he's just going to tell me by email, you know, thanks, but no thanks.
So I'm now Googling Michael. Okay. And I see he's a professor at MIT. He's got his own cancer lab at the Koch Cancer Institute and all this. And in the midst of the Googling, I see that his wife's name is Sunyoung Pai. And I realize I had gotten a connection request from her on LinkedIn way back when Michael first reached out on LinkedIn back in October. I didn't know who she was. So I had not accepted the connection request. And this time now I knew who she was. I accepted the connection request. And I guess that helped because she got a message saying I'd accept it.
So Sunyoung then came up to me and said, Adam just accepted my friend request. I don't think he's going to blow you off. You really need to read his message and see what it says. So at that point I did. And then I still was hesitant for about another 24 hours.
This is like dating.
Yeah, well, I completely unknowingly, I just put him through, you know, he thought the worst for 2 weeks. I still feel bad about it. So he finally manned up and called me the next day. And we spoke for 2 hours and discovered we have so much in common, not just the appearance. There's tons of stuff that we have in common.
Our childhood was similar. Even halfway through the conversation, we were finishing each other's sentences.
Yeah. So like I said, it's been a bromance ever since.
So what do you bring to each other's lives now? Michael, what does Adam bring to your life?
I've never had a brother before. So it's been incredibly exciting to have a genetically related brother, someone who it's like a second part of me. All these things about me that no one else shared, suddenly I share with Adam. Our obsession with loading the dishwasher, our ability to be completely monomaniacal about a single issue while letting everything else collapse around us. It's creepy how similar we are.
And Adam, what does it bring into your life?
Well, Michael's just an amazing guy. I mean, I am just so delighted to have him in my life. And I'm so grateful that this technology appeared. I mean, I'm sorry I missed the first 61 years of knowing each other, though we did joke about, you know, if we met as children or earlier in our lives, who knows if we would have liked each other so much. But it's really just a wonderful thing. And you know, there are more members of the family, too. But I'm lucky so far just because we're both here. So he's got more people to discover in greater depth as well.
I want to stay on that for a second because, you know, if your father was a sperm donor, there may be others. Have you thought about that? And have you thought about trying to find others?
So I've definitely thought about that. As best I can tell, looking through the databases through our DNA test, no one else so far has emerged, but it's certainly conceivable that someone else is out there.
And Adam, would you want to find them if they are?
Sure. I mean, I haven't done a sample or anything like that, because I think Jakey's sample and now Michael's enough, you know, to pick that up. But I'm not sure. And I said to Michael, you know, I wonder what thought Dad gave it when he did it.
So that's my last question to the two of you. If he were sitting with the two of you right now, Michael, what would you say to him?
I'd give him a big hug and say, thank you for doing this. I wouldn't exist if he hadn't done it. I wish I could sit and talk with him for hours and hours and hours and learn everything about him.
And Adam, how about you?
Really, if he were sitting here with us, I'd just be watching him and Michael just enjoying each other so much. They really would. It's astonishing. All the things. I mean, we talk about how Michael and I are similar in ways. There are also all these things that are similar with our dad as well.
And that is Adam Weisenberg and Michael Yaffe. Thank you so much to both of you for telling us your story.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Staying with this story, two half-brothers united for the first time thanks to DNA testing. It raises questions for us and maybe for you too. Questions like, how common is this kind of story? Could I be caught up in a family change, disruption? For some families, maybe scandal, even if I never take a DNA test of my own. What are the safeguards in place? And how do I reach out if I find out information like this? and I want to be connected with new family members. We want to hear from you. Have you gotten your own surprising results from a DNA test kit? Do you have concerns about privacy around your genetic information? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now to help us have this conversation, Françoise Baylis, a professor of bioethics at Dalhousie University in Halifax. Françoise, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
So here's the story, Adam and Michael. One learns he has a brother out there he didn't know about. The other has no idea that the father who raised him isn't genetically related to him. The truth comes out through a DNA test. What are your reactions?
Well, I think one of the things that's particularly interesting in this case is that the half-brothers have said they're delighted to have each other in their lives, and they seem really enthusiastic. But I think it's important to recognize that that's not always the outcome. So sometimes people are actually shocked, surprised, angry. And so there are many different ways in which this story can play out.
Do we know, is there one way this story plays out more commonly than others? Do we know, on balance, do people want to find this information out like Adam did, or they don't because it turns their worlds upside down?
Well, I think one of the things that's particularly important to appreciate is that sometimes people are not actually looking for this information. So they believe that their social parent is also their biological parent, and it actually comes as a surprise to them. And that happens probably in a greater number of cases than we assume, partly because about 10% of the population probably finds themselves in this situation. Now, not all 10% are out there looking for their DNA heritage. But I think it's an important thing to appreciate that sometimes this is a complete surprise to someone. They weren't actually looking for a family member, and they find out for the first time that perhaps a parent has lied to them. And they then reflect on their whole life and start reinterpreting a lot of those social relations.
I almost can feel the world sort of falling out underneath my chair with the idea of having that come into my life. When people ask you, should I take a test like this? What do you tell them? And have you ever taken a DNA test of your own?
I haven't taken a DNA test, and largely it's because there isn't any information that I'm looking for. But I think that's the really important thing for people to think about. Why would you want to take this test? And there are any number of reasons. And so, quite frankly, some people take it just for entertainment. You know, somebody gives them a gift that allows them to do a DNA test, and they think, oh, sure, that'll be fun. What will I learn? Other people actually have as a hobby genealogy. And so now they're thinking about DNA information as potentially being very helpful for them to build on their family tree. We do know also that some people are actually looking for family members. And so, for example, they may know that they have been adopted and they want to put their information into a database in case their parents, their birth parents, are also in that database and they may be able to find each other.
Lastly,
one thing people are looking for is actually health information. And so I think it really matters why you're looking for a particular set of information about your DNA, but also that you understand you may find things you weren't looking for.
I'd like to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. Let's talk to Lisa, who's calling from Melrose. Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was actually driving and almost ran off the road when I heard the story of Michael and Adam. My dad was also an OBGYN in New Jersey in the 50s and was also part of a covert sperm donor program because it was $25 for each donation. And so this year we discovered, my sisters and I, that we two half-siblings, two women that we knew nothing about. And again, another eerie connection is one of the my half-sisters is also somebody who's in field of reproductive rights. She's a dean of a law school, and that's her specialty. And she had no idea that her biological father was an OBGYN who was also in the field. So it's shocking to me. I think it's probably more common than we realize.
Lisa, I thank you for sharing your story, and I'm sorry we caused you some concern. Be careful, folks, if you're driving. I'm not making light of that. We know that happens sometimes. You get this information over the air, but I'm glad you called and shared your story, Lisa. I'll come back to you now, Françoise. You said a minute ago 10% of people are potentially in this situation, not all looking for DNA testing. This is a story that's unfolding about this 1950s aspect of this and sperm donors that were mixed in with fathers who were getting fertility treatment. Is this one of those cases where a scientific advancement in DNA testing is leading to the revealing of something entirely else in the world of science that we didn't know about?
It's certainly revealing a lot of information that people didn't know was potentially available to them. And one of the things that I would like to emphasize is that this is not just a story from the 1950s. I was in graduate school in the 1980s in a philosophy department, and I remember the male members of that department were invited to come and be sperm donors. So those would be children that are out there in the world that are much younger than Michael and Adam. And so I think one of the things to appreciate is that this is not just, you know, sort of passé, if you will. It is very much a reality today. And today, because we have the capacity to do this DNA testing, we actually have a new ethical issue, which is that many of those sperm donors were promised anonymity. That's a false promise today. We can't actually do that anymore.
As we saw in the case of Michael and Adam, we have another caller on the line who I think wants to raise a little bit of the ethics question as well. Jennifer's on the line in Concord. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi, I'm an identical twin, and I've been asked to participate in, you know, different research projects that would have my information be entered into different databases. And every time I've been asked, I've wondered ethically, what kind of responsibility do I have to my sister? Because as identical twins, it would, you know, ultimately I'm signing her up too.
Oh, Jennifer, such a good question. And Françoise, I mean, on the medical side, we have such tight restrictions, like HIPAA laws, such great restrictions on privacy. But as I understand it, when one's genetic information enters some of these databases, it's almost the Wild West. It's almost open season.
Well, that's actually a great question because we've done a lot of work in a Western context to really place a lot of emphasis on consent. And people make autonomous choices around their healthcare and a number of other personal decisions. The problem with DNA is that it's actually not just yours because you share this with a number of other people.
Like Jennifer and was saying there.
Absolutely. But even if you're not an identical twin, you still share some of your genetic information just with your regular siblings and with your offspring and with your parents. And so you may, for example, be wanting to do a DNA test. Let's say, for example, for a health reason, you're concerned maybe about Huntington's disease or you're concerned about a particular kind of breast cancer, and you decide you want to do this. But as you find out information about yourself, you're potentially finding out information that's relevant to your siblings, and they may not have wanted that information. They may not be in the same headspace that you're in. And so I think there's a lot of ways in which we don't actually have a good system for dealing with consent when we're actually dealing with familial information.
Why don't we? This feels really momentous. This feels like this can turn people's lives upside down when they may not even have chosen. You know, as Jennifer raises with her identical twin sister, why don't we have better protections in place?
I think largely it's because we don't want to expand the circle of people that have authority over decision-making, because then you're actually inviting conflict. And then it's not clear what the rules of the game should be. Why can't I get information about myself? Why should somebody else be able to constrain my ability to do that? And so one of the things we have done in an effort to protect privacy in different places is to introduce legislation that actually limits who can at least access your information. Now, that doesn't deal with the family problem where people necessarily, you know, would have preferred you not to go looking for the information. But we have put in place things which in some, you know, jurisdictions would prohibit insurance companies from getting access to that information. And that can be really important if you're trying to look for health insurance or life insurance and they have access to this kind of personal information. We've also made it such that in some cases, you have the opportunity to stop the companies that are collecting your data from selling that on to other people for whatever use they might make. And so I think one of the things that's really important for people who are going to do this is to make sure they understand who can have access to that information?
I'd like to grab one more call here. We have many. I'd like to grab one more. We've got Deb on the line in Worcester County. Deb, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Jump in, Deb.
Okay. So last year, I discovered that I have a new older sister. I had an older sister, and she and I, you know, kind of thought that there was someone else out there, but just for fun, I did one of those commercial DNA tests, got one for myself and my husband as a holiday gift. Sure enough, there she is. And she had known, my new older sister, had known that she was adopted from birth. My mother, as a teenager, gave birth to a child 60 years ago and gave her up for adoption, which was the best course of action at that time.
Deb, I'm going to thank you. I'm sorry to stop you there. I'm going to thank you for your story, but your line is starting to cut out. We're starting to get some blips. And I know there's more, and I'm not disrespecting your story, but we can also work with the part of your story you've just told. So I'm going to do that now. I'm going to turn back to Françoise. So many different scenarios people could be confronting. And I wonder the messiness of family and how it gets exposed with this moment of science where there's something that we can do and maybe sometimes needs to be conversations about what we should do. I'm sorry, that's not a well-formed question, but it's so complicated, Françoise.
I think one of the things that the stories we've heard thus far highlight is actually the importance of truth-telling and openness, especially within families. And so if we think back to the stories we've heard thus far, one of the things that's important would be at some point in a child's life to let them know, you know, you have a sibling. I got pregnant as a young person, and, you know, the best thing I could do for that child at that time was to give them up for adoption. Are we interested in finding that person? So that's an open conversation. Another story is, you know, I was a student at a university, or I was in an OBGYN practice. There were people who wanted to have children. They could not for any number of reasons. And so I was a sperm donor. I think it's really important today to tell children who are born of reproductive technologies, you know, a surrogate was involved in, you know, your birth story, or a sperm or an egg donor was involved in your birth story. I think it's really important for people to have that information so they can decide how to use it.
Françoise, you've been a wonderful guide for us. That's Françoise Baylis, a professor of bioethics at Dalhousie University in Halifax. Françoise, really appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you. Great questions.
Thank you. And listen, listeners, I just want you to know how many more people called, how many more stories there were, like the one we heard from Adam and Michael. We'll be thinking about that, and we appreciate you wanting to share your story with us as well. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.